Next speaker is Mary Nell, and the title of her paper is Violent Enforcement of Traditional Beliefs, Witchcraft, Vigilantism, and the Role of the State. Just a brief introduction, Mary Nell is a senior lecturer at the Stellenbosch University at the Faculty of Law. Thank you, Mary, we look forward to your paper.
I'd like you to imagine the following. You have a jealous neighbor who disapproves of your brother's courting her daughter. She remonstrates with you and your brother, saying, "You're all going to die." Within a month, two of your brothers have died under mysterious circumstances. You consult a trusted and expert private investigator. And this person points in no uncertain terms to your neighbor as the cause of their deaths. Distressed and weeping, you confront her with your suspicions. She retaliates by uttering the grim words, "You will not see the setting of the sun today." You are terrified, knowing full well that she's willing and able to carry out this threat. You attempt to lay charges of murder and intimidation against her at the local police station. But after hearing your story, the policeman laughs derisively and declines to investigate the incident. You are charged with defaming her instead. Improbable, you might think. Why on earth would the police be reluctant to help prosecute the neighbor, a suspected murderer who poses an immediate and serious danger to anyone who rubs her up the wrong way? The answer is simple. The accused neighbor is a witch. These facts are taken straight from a court case called State versus McQuantor. The only changes I've made are that McQuantor actually obtained his evidence of the cause of his brother's deaths from a diviner. And by his own admission, rather than taking his story to the police, he took a cane knife and cut off his neighbor's head so that she could not rise up and bewitch him. And he severed her hands because they'd handled the muti with which he'd caused his brother's deaths. In my talk today, I want to show how people like Mr. McQuantor can't rely on the state to protect them from the chilling dread of witchcraft, as Justice Holmes put it in the McQuantor case. I want to explain why they feel compelled to take the law into their own hands. In the case of Mr. McQuantor, to literally excise the muti-polluted hands of evil sorcerers. I lastly want to consider ways in which the task of addressing witchcraft evils might be restored to the hands of the state. The story of Mr. McQuantor illustrates the dilemma facing a huge number of South Africans today, those who live life in a world with witches. Studies show that witchcraft beliefs are strong, common, and widespread in Africa. In this paradigm, people's existence is permeated by a presumption of malice. Belief in the existence of human beings who secretly use supernatural power to harm others gives ordinary misfortune a moral significance. Witchcraft answers the question of why this misfortune happened to this person at this precise moment. By attributing hardship to sorcery, inexplicable suffering is transformed into the intentional infliction of harm. Significantly, those who've been wronged perceive no meaningful distinction between ordinary criminal violence and witchcraft. Since both are a form of evil perpetrated by someone, they likewise form part of the same moral universe of evil. The illegitimate use of occult force is regarded as being unjust in much the same way as the illegitimate use of physical force is. And those subject to spiritual injustice at the hands of others similarly desire justice. The state criminal justice apparatus is, as will be seen, woefully inadequate when it comes to addressing the spiritual insecurities of its citizens. And this is potentially extremely problematic for both the authorities and their subjects. To explain the depth of the problem, it's useful to take a step back and consider the nature of the state-citizen relationship. According to Beetham, for state power to be legitimate, it should be normatively justifiable to its subordinates in terms of a common framework of belief. Political legitimacy is thus the product of the congruence or lack of congruence between a given system of power and the beliefs, values, and expectations which provide its justification. As regards the state-citizen power relationship, one of the fundamental grounds justifying the state's existence, what Ashforth calls the bedrock of political legitimacy, is the expectation that it will protect its citizens from threats of violence. And in this, the South African state is failing its citizens dismally. The formal criminal justice system is, to a large extent, unable to guarantee collective security and social order in the face of high crime levels. And the unsurprising consequence of this is vigilantism. Vigilantism is a phenomenon whereby individuals take the law into their own hands and resort to non-state sanctioned self-help, usually aimed at inflicting violent punishment on those they label as deviant. Rightly or wrongly, vigilantes regard the state as not having fulfilled its side of the social contract, requiring it to maintain law and order, and they respond by co-opting the responsibilities and the authority of the formal criminal justice system to punish deviants themselves. However, I contend that the state citizen incongruence of belief goes beyond citizen dissatisfaction with perceived ineffective enforcement of existing criminal sanctions. Where witchcraft beliefs are concerned, the formal avenues of redress are essentially irrelevant, in the sense that the state does not deem the right to be free from occult violence as an interest worthy of protection. State law enforcement in the spiritual sphere is not merely inadequate, but non-existent. Although the 1957 Witchcraft Suppression Act does nominally criminalize the conduct of professing or pretending to be a witch, this crime cannot effectively be prosecuted. The reason is simple. The formal criminal justice system enshrines principles of evidence that cannot take cognizance of the expertise of diviners, those able to point out witches. In fact, the act bans divination too. Since witchcraft cannot be witnessed by ordinary human perception, it is impossible to obtain objective concrete proof beyond reasonable doubt that a person is a witch. Overall, South African criminal law characterizes witches as the victims, allowed to run free, while their accusers, the witch hunters and diviners, are punished. As will now be explained a bit further, the disconnect between state and community beliefs regarding witchcraft's potential harmfulness and reprehensibility is what engenders vigilante violence against suspected witches. I now examine more closely the significance of witch hunting for state legitimacy. Beetham's conception of legitimacy, referred to earlier, also entails a dimension whereby legitimacy is conferred through expressed consent. When a system of power becomes chronically unable to justify itself in terms of shared beliefs, in the present instance, due to the incongruent state-citizen beliefs regarding the dangers posed by witches, subordinates may choose to actively engage in acts of delegitimation. The ultimate demonstration of delegitimation entails subordinates collectively presenting themselves as an alternative source of state power. Of legitimate power. This, I submit, is exactly what those who engage in witchcraft violence are doing. I now want to examine some of the counter-legitimation strategies engaged in by vigilantes who target witches. An excellent strategy for achieving external legitimation is to convince community members that it is socially beneficial for them to come together to eliminate a common enemy. Anti-witchcraft vigilantism may firstly be a unifying force, repairing tears in the social fabric caused by disputes. And secondly, it may be a divisive force, promoting social solidarity through the violent elimination of social malefactors. As regards the unifying effect of anti-witchcraft violence, vigilantes must portray their conduct to be a product of beliefs that are central to their community's cultural ethos, not deviant from or marginal to it. In this, they seem to have succeeded. There's ample evidence that those who destroy people accused of being witches and wizards are seen by others in the community as selfless heroes who are committed to freeing people from supernatural evils. Interestingly, too, the violence against witches is often carried out in a manner that crudely parallels the functioning of the formal criminal justice system. drawing on the state's procedural and symbolic forms of legitimacy, serves to disguise the distinction between formal and informal justice, thus increasing the likelihood of law-abiding community members identifying with and endorsing anti-witchcraft violence. In addition to anti-witchcraft violence being a resource to forcefully articulate and impose a vision of community consensus, witch hunters symbolically create enemies to reinforce the normative boundaries between us and them, thereby enhancing social solidarity and group coherence. Girard's scapegoat mechanism explains collective violence as a social group's deflecting the potential uncontrolled violence of the society itself by focusing all its wrath on a sacrificial victim, a surrogate target for all active or endemic community tension and conflict. While any person could potentially be targeted, the ideal scapegoat is a marginal, liminal, or borderline person, simultaneously familiar and foreign. The targets of witch purging in South Africa are often poor, elderly women, perceived to have deviated from community norms, or with whom the victim has had a conflict. The antisocial, over-individualistic, morose, or difficult may also be accused due to their perceived undermining of community cohesion. Witchcraft killings often use methods involving the excessive use of force, like necklacing. The ensuing death is exceptionally excruciating, and the burning of the body symbolizes purification, with the flames signifying the total elimination of the defilement that has endangered the health, well-being, and order of the community. Death by burning is also particularly final, destroying the soul as well as the body and preventing it from returning to haunt the living. Witch executions may thus be seen as a way of expelling evil in order to renegotiate the wholeness of a community disrupted by misfortune. The momentary, spontaneous, violent unanimity achieved by a community through witch killing potently demonstrates vigilantes' legitimacy-enhancing power and their heroic ability to defend the community against the evil forces that threaten to destroy social order. If it is correct to characterize witch-killing vigilantism as a challenge to state legitimacy, the state must engage with witchcraft. It cannot just prohibit communities from creating alternative, violent forms of protective justice, while refusing to address malign forms of the occult itself. In so doing, the state would open itself to the charge of either ignoring the dangers facing the community or being in league with the evil forces themselves, neither of which is conducive to enhanced legitimacy. Action is required, but what? I now consider the possible state responses to witchcraft engendered vigilantism. Specifically, what steps the state might take to re-legitimate itself. A first option is for the state to address and attempt to eliminate the real underlying causes of its delegitimation. Superficially, the most obvious re-legitimation solution would be for authorities to crack down hard on witches. In this vein, the 1996 Rallochy Commission of Inquiry into Witchcraft Violence proposed promulgating a new Witchcraft Control Act, criminalizing all witchcraft practices. By accepting that witchcraft is true and fighting its negative manifestations, the state may indeed demonstrate that it is sensitive towards people's feelings of vulnerability to the occult and is attempting to address them. But at what cost? Tebe argues that such attempts to punish witches should be resisted as being contrary to the South African state's ideals as a liberal democracy. He points to the arbitrariness of using divination to determine guilt as being contrary to the rule of law. He also asserts that potentially subjecting non-believers to witchcraft charges could undermine their human dignity and autonomy. Lutzen further notes that enforcing anti-witchcraft legislation could violate the right to a fair trial due to the virtually insurmountable difficulty of proving a causal link between the alleged witchcraft and the harm. In addition, she raises the fear that elderly, poor women would be easy targets for witchcraft accusations, thereby entrenching social inequality. The human rights-related perils of criminalizing witchcraft per se outweigh its potential benefits for state legitimation. while citizens may feel more secure and may even be less inclined to resort to self-help, the risk of arbitrary punishment weakens the rule of law, the very foundation of the state's moral legitimacy and authority. I will now consider other more human rights-friendly options whereby the state might restore legitimacy either by accommodating witch hunters within the formal criminal justice system in some way, or by impairing their legitimate status in the eyes of the community. A noteworthy strategy for re-legitimation through inclusion has been for the state to co-opt traditional healers as a form of state-sanctioned response to occult insecurity. Section 4 of the 2007 Traditional Health Practitioners Act establishes an agency tasked with regulating and registering traditional healers, including diviners. The Act also recognizes the supernatural basis for traditional healing. This is a significant development. Being assured by a diviner that the evil forces dispatched by a witch will be returned to their source to kill that witch may indeed appease witchcraft victims and make them less inclined to retaliate violently against occult assault. Thus, implicitly incorporating diviners into its arsenal of spiritual crime fighters may indeed indirectly boost state legitimacy. In addition to re-legitimation through inclusion, the state may employ the formal criminal justice system to swiftly suppress and punish vigilantism, thereby symbolically reasserting its claim to the exclusive exercise of coercive force and also branding vigilantes as enemies by stigmatizing them as criminals. Punishing harm against, as opposed to by, witches has long been the predominant state strategy. The criminal justice system in South Africa has walked an uneasy tightrope between condemning as abhorrent the violent manifestations of anti-witchcraft beliefs and accommodating these beliefs to a certain extent. Generally speaking, when witch killing cases come to trial, belief in witchcraft is viewed at most as mitigating, not exonerating. Complete defenses, such as self-defense or provocation, rarely succeed. Mr. Mokoto, referred to earlier, raised both these defenses. The court dismissed his reliance on self-defense, holding that Mokoto was not in immediate danger, since the threat concerned was supernatural death. Justice Holmes held, "The common law of South Africa in regard to murder and self-defense reflects the thinking of Western civilization. Hence, in considering the unlawfulness of the appellant's conduct, his benighted belief in the blight of witchcraft cannot be considered reasonable. To hold otherwise would be to plunge the law backward into the dark ages." The court also found that his being afraid of evil witchcraft and having been provoked by his victim had actually contributed to his subjective intention to kill her, not excluded it. However, despite the gruesome nature of the crime, he was only sentenced to 5 years imprisonment. His moral blameworthiness was lessened due to a bona fide and genuine fear that witchcraft harm was immediately threatening. Although this case was decided in 1971, contemporary legal attitudes to witchcraft are very similar. Although the right to enjoy one's tradition and culture and the right to freedom of religion and belief are protected in the Constitution, the South African legal paradigm continues to be a very much a Western one. Courts do lessen punishments for private citizens who engage in self-help to protect their communities against enchantment, but the prevailing judicial attitude remains insensitive and condescending. Courts still characterize witchcraft beliefs as unreasonable and contrary to public policy. There's little hope that attempting to portray witch killers as dangerous enemies holds much legitimacy-enhancing potential for the state. Indeed, due to the widely held societal characterization of witch-purging vigilantes as community-protecting heroes, doing so may achieve little more than confirm community conceptions of the police and government officials as foes rather than allies in the fight against sorcery. While there is no denying that the often gruesome manifestations of anti-witchcraft violence need to be punished, solving the problem of witchcraft vigilantism is beyond the remit of the criminal justice system alone. It is submitted that state re-legitimation. Most crucially, requires the state to delegitimate the option of violent problem solving. It needs to exemplify and extol the merits of a culture that respects and upholds human rights in its dealings with citizens. By being seen to prioritize justice over revenge, humanity over brutality, and inclusivity over intolerance, the state may re-educate citizens by its own example, thus serving serving as a positive role model for the rest of society. If the state can manage to educate the public about the reasons for and benefits of extending fundamental rights and freedoms, including due process rights, even to the social outcasts and marginal members of society, it can be hoped that this will make citizens less inclined to resort to violent self-help in witchcraft cases. For such education is certainly needed in a society where the willingness of a person to practice witchcraft automatically cancels their rights to membership in the human community. Indeed, it negates their claim to be considered human. Only when witches are viewed as human will it be recognized that they too are entitled to claim human rights to protect themselves from the righteous anger and justice of the community. I would love to believe that if the state succeeds in persuading citizens to give credence to its self-legitimated identity as guarantor of human rights, citizens may indeed be prepared to re-legitimate the criminal justice system and will follow the state's example by refraining from taking the law into their own hands to punish witches. However, I cannot help but agree with Niehaus that unless the causes of witchcraft believers' predicaments, fears, and anxieties are addressed, namely their lived experiences of misery, marginalization, illness, poverty, and insecurity, there can be no lasting solution to witchcraft-related violence.
Mary, thank you very much. We already got one question, and I'll take the second question and then thank you.
Yes, I'm going to ask a question that I asked at a conference on harm in Africa in 2008, and I was kind of rebuffed, but your mention of elderly women and the connection to inequality, and in your last remarks, I think it's because of what motivates to leave a witchcraft. The question that I had at that time was looking at accusations, and they may be false accusations, and they may be against people who actually do practice witchcraft. Accusations which seem often to be focused on elderly women and children. I wonder if this was, if there was an economic motive here, if this was sort of the limits of Africans, famed ability to provide for each other in community. I mean, I see this as an American through, we have no social safety net and we can't even ensure all of our people get health care. So it seems like particularly the focus on these marginal and vulnerable communities might be a way of sort of getting rid of people who are seen to take resources.
That could be a cause of witchcraft violence is, it often seems to be provoked by envy. So, which is a bit strange. Maybe it's sort of saying, okay, this person is below me and they're envious of me, so therefore they're using witchcraft to obtain almost a leg up, whereas they wouldn't otherwise be able to. But there's also the phenomenon where powerful people are accused of being witches. How would they get into that position of power unless they've used witchcraft? So it sort of goes both ways, but apparently, a strong underlying motivator is envy, sort of jealousy, insecurity. But yes, I would say the economic fact, it would play a role. But I would say it would go wider than economics. It would go towards almost social power in the community, other inequalities apart from just economic inequality.
We'll have one last question, to be fair, and we're already in lunchtime. So if anyone wants to ask an additional question, there's still lunch as well. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. My understanding of witchcraft is that it is a practice of magic, and especially the black magic as a thing called, and the use of spells and perhaps invocation of spirits. Now, the message I've gotten from your presentation is that witchcraft is evil, and there is a need for the states to come in to regulate it. My question is there no possibility that people with this power, they use it for positive changes?
There's definitely a possibility, but when I'm talking about witchcraft, I'm defining it per se as the evil form. But it could well be that one and the same individual could engage in sort of evil witchcraft and witchcraft that might, or sort of magic which might build people up. So there's definitely an overlap in that sense. But when I'm talking about witchcraft, I'm specifically talking about malign almost manifestations of it.
Okay, thank you very much, and a word of thanks and appreciation to all the speakers once again. Thank you.